On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. So a New York Times national politics reporter last week described Wisconsin as one of the swingiest of swing states, and every court decision that changes who gets to vote carries outsized weight. So we're breaking down recent decisions by a federal appeals court on multiple voting laws and regulations. Did you hear about the appeals court ruling last week? What questions do you have about how it impacts state elections? And then the state Supreme Court came down with a decision to hear oral arguments in late September on an effort to purge voter rolls. Have you been following the voter roll case? What questions do you have about how the state purges voters with out-of-state registration? We're at 800-642-1234. Laura White is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter. She co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. Laura, welcome back.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the Supreme Court ruling last week on voter rolls. What happened there?
So what happened last week was kind of interesting. It's a part of the process that normally doesn't get a lot of attention in court cases. It's part of kind of the scheduling and logistics leading up to the arguments in a case. So what happened was the court issued an order in response to a petition from the plaintiffs in the case, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, asking to expedite the arguments or to actually bypass oral arguments entirely and just rule on the case based on briefings. And the court came back and said, you know, we don't want to do that. We want to move forward with a regular briefing schedule, regular oral arguments. And this is a really big deal because everyone's watching this voter purge case really closely in the lead up to November and kind of trying to figure out when the court might rule and if it'll affect, you know, who's on the voter rolls in November for a really big presidential election.
So the justices rule in a 5-2 decision. Justice Rebecca Bradley dissents. What did she share about her reasons?
So she had a very, very fiery dissent. She basically said that in her view, the court is not doing its duty to the people of Wisconsin. She said that she kind of touched on that phrase that, you know, even people outside of the courts hear, justice delayed is justice denied. She said because the election is coming up, the court not moving quickly to make a decision that is relevant to the integrity of the election, in her view, you know, who's on the voter rolls, she said is kind of an abdication of the court's duty, that it has a duty to move quickly on this and it has chosen not to.
Well, so this case stems from way back in October 2019 to how 230 voters from the Wisconsin Elections Commission, you know, indicating that they believed they had moved from their current address. How did we get to 129,000 voters?
So this number, it was 232,000, as you mentioned early on, and has dwindled to about 130 at the last check. And that's because we're working with a list of people that is still interacting with the state and still responding to this official mailing from the state. So it's kind of like if you're waiting for somebody to reach out, make a phone call, take an action, they'll be removed from the list, I think is a easy way to describe it. And people are continuing as this case moves forward to kind of interact with the state and do the things that they need to do to get off the list. So as time goes by, this list has gotten smaller and will likely continue to get smaller. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons, too, that people are watching so closely the timeline for this case and when exactly arguments happen and when a ruling might happen.
We're talking with Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter. She's breaking down the recent state Supreme Court order. Have you been following the voter roll case? What questions do you have about how the state maintains its voter rolls? Have you encountered confusion at the polls about your ID or registration? What happened? Join in at 800-642-1234. Laurel, explain why the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty brought this case in the first place.
So this is kind of a complicated process to explain, and how this list is created and how people get on and off of it. So I'll start from the beginning and take a deep breath.
Will do.
Basically, what happens here is the state subscribes to this nationwide service called the Electronic Registration Information Center. And what they do for states in helping them maintain their voter rolls is basically look out for when people register at a different address than the one they've voted at on through any sort of government channel. So whether they submit a change of address form at the post office, they register a new vehicle at a different address. ERIC flags them, the organization.
That's the acronym.
Information Center. Uh-huh. Yep, ERIC flags them for the state and says, hey, we think that this person may have moved. So the state sends a postcard to that person at the registration, their voter registration address, the place where they've, you know, voted last, and says, we have reason to believe that you may have moved. Do you still live here? And this is the part that gets kind of tricky. According to the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which filed this lawsuit, the person that gets the postcard under state law has to respond within 30 days by contacting the state and saying, I still live here, in order to stay on the voter rolls at that address. Under current Wisconsin Elections Commission policy, which was voted on by members of the commission, there are six members, they're political appointees, they have decided that their policy is to let people stay on the voter rolls for up to 2 years if they don't respond to that mailing. And that's because of some experiences that they've had in the past where people have been erroneously removed, had to be put back on. There had to be supplemental lists of people at the polling place because of confusion about this. So they set that time frame to kind of smooth out the process a little bit. But Will says, you can't do that. That's violating state law.
And so you see a very wide difference between 30 days and a couple years.
Absolutely. And that's where the sticking point is in the lawsuit.
Is ERIC still a system that is widely used?
Yeah. You know, a large number of states do this. And we've had, of course, a lot of conversations in recent years about the integrity of voter rolls and how states maintain them and how states make sure that people aren't erroneously voting in a particular area. You know, voter fraud, basically the voter fraud conversation. And ERIC is considered to be one of the tools to mitigate that.
How will the makeup of the state Supreme Court change by the time these oral arguments are heard in this case after the 29th of September?
This is another really fascinating element of this Supreme Court order from last week. So not only are we getting a little hint into, you know, when they're going to rule and that kind of being closer to election day than some people might have thought, the makeup of the court is going to change. Conservative Justice Daniel Kelly ends his term on the court on August 1st, and he's going to be replaced by liberal justice-elect Jill Karofsky. So the partisan balance of the court, which is currently 5-2 in favor of conservatives, is going to shift to 4-3, which, you know, obviously there's still a conservative majority there, but it's narrowed. And it's not completely out of the question that we see bipartisan decisions and justices sometimes shifting. And so anytime that narrows, it increases the likelihood that we could have a decision with the liberal side of the court.
WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White is our guide to recent court decisions involving election laws and regulations in our state. What questions do you have about the Federal Appeals Court decision last week on Wisconsin election laws? What's your take on restricting early voting to 2 weeks? Do you vote early? Share your experience, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with more State Cap with Laurel White here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're digging into recent court rulings that affect elections in Wisconsin. Last week, a three-judge federal appeals court upheld voting restrictions that had been pending for years. Wisconsin's photo ID law not in question. What questions do you have about the appeals court ruling, especially around early voting? Have you followed this litigation? How do you feel about it? We're at 800-642-1234, and WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White is our guide. So, Laurel, the federal Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on a matter regarding Wisconsin elections last week. Can you bring us up to speed on the history of this case? Who brought it?
So this case was brought by One Wisconsin Institute, which is a liberal advocacy organization, and they were essentially challenging a broad swath of election-related laws that had been passed under Republican control in the state capitol. So Republican-backed changes to elections essentially since 2011. And those include, you know, the voter ID law, some restrictions on early voting. Those are kind of the big two, and some smaller technical changes that in One Wisconsin Institute's argument made it disproportionately difficult for minority communities, young people, and the elderly to vote in Wisconsin.
All right. So what did the ruling say about early voting in Wisconsin?
So the ruling actually reversed what the federal district court decided in 2016, and Wisconsin's limits on early voting are going to go back into place. What Republicans had done in Wisconsin was kind of specified the window of time that people could go and cast in-person absentee ballots. So go to their clerk's office and vote in person before Election Day. That period of time had been narrowed to 13 days before Election Day. So the 2 weeks leading up to it, excluding the Monday before Election Day. And the reason that they wanted to do this was they said it was a really too broad of a difference between cities like Madison and Milwaukee and how much early voting they were offering and rural communities in Wisconsin. So Milwaukee and Madison had been offering in some cases several weeks of this option to go and cast a ballot in person early, whereas some communities in Wisconsin only had a couple days. And they said, that's not really fair. We feel like it needs to be uniform across the state. The pushback to that in the more urban communities was, well, we have more people, we have more demand, we need this to be spread out, we want to offer more. So that was kind of the back and forth about early voting. And what's going to happen is we're going to go back to that 13-day window.
So at the 13-day window, so that is one piece of this appeals court ruling. How did the ruling come down on Wisconsin's voter ID law?
So the big change here has to do with student voters. Part of the decision that was actually upheld from the lower court, so this was a part of the decision that was in favor of the liberal groups, which for the most part, the decision was not, is that students in Wisconsin are going to be able to use expired student IDs as identification at the polls. The argument was that, you know, not allowing them to do that was discriminatory and made it too difficult for them to provide the appropriate ID at the polling place. And interestingly, the decision also related to students doesn't require the use of these dorm lists. People who have been following this case since 2016 or read things about it may have heard the phrase dorm lists. And basically what those are, it was a requirement to have residency and citizenship status on a dorm, if you lived in a dorm, provided to the state to prove that, you know, prove your residency basically and make sure that people weren't voting when they shouldn't be. And that process won't need to be used either under the court's ruling.
We're talking with WPR politics reporter Laurel White. She's breaking down the federal court ruling on Wisconsin election laws. What do you want to know about how this ruling affects state elections? What's your take on restricting early voting to 2 weeks? Do you vote early? Share your experience, 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Karen is with us from Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning. Every single one of these things that you're talking about are all to keep people from voting, number one, to make it more difficult to vote. That's not a representation of our representative government. But my point is that the thing I wanted to say is that the whole thing about this was to because of voter fraud. And my understanding is that there were like 7 people who erroneously voted, and most of those people were felons, and they didn't know that they couldn't vote. And so we have this whole big thing to suppress votes, really, let's call it that. And so could you comment on the voter fraud? And it's very upsetting as a citizen. Thank you.
Karen, thank you for the call. Laurel, you know, Karen's seeing this as a suppression of votes, these moves in these lawsuits, and not exactly countering a problem of voter fraud.
And that was a huge part. I covered the arguments in this case back in 2016, and that was a huge part of their case, was that voter fraud is not rampant in Wisconsin. There aren't a large number of cases. For folks that are interested in kind of the different kinds of voter fraud and what has been identified by the state, that's something that the Wisconsin Elections Commission releases information on. And I'm trying to think, I wish I could come up with a number off the top of my head the last time they put out a press release about voter fraud in Wisconsin and how many people were found to have committed voter fraud. It wasn't a huge number. So I think that that is definitely part of the conversation, that people say, you know, we don't have, thousands and thousands of people committing voter fraud in Wisconsin. These laws, these restrictions are overreactions on the part of the Republican-controlled legislature. And Republicans push back and say, well, you know, we need to do everything we can to ensure that people have faith in our elections. The system isn't working if people don't believe in it. And, the structure that we've put in place allows people to know that their vote is safe.
Let's bring in another call now. Carolyn is with us from Madison. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Just thinking about people having to wear face masks and voter ID cards. And it just doesn't go together for me. I mean, voter ID always seemed rather absurd to me, but this is extra absurd that it's still... Well, I don't know what to do about it. So,
Carolyn, so you're saying that showing your voter ID and wearing face masks, you'll have to pull down your face masks in order to see that.
I don't know what they're going to ask. How we shouldn't be required to have voter ID in the first place. So,
all right, Carolyn, thank you for the call. Laurel, where does voter ID stand in Wisconsin?
Voter ID has had a number of legal challenges against it, and it has survived all of those. So voter ID is seemingly here to stay in Wisconsin. I think to her point, you know, we know that clerks for the April election talked about how voter ID would work and how people could, you know, identify themselves with masks and things and make sure that everything was on the up and up. And I think that's something that the conversation will continue about in November in terms of distancing and all of these new kind of realities that we live in and have to work within when we do things like an in-person election.
Let's bring in Donna now in Adams. Hi, Donna.
Hi. My question is, Eric, the service that monitors who might be a duplicate voter or may have not be a legal voter at a certain address, who funds that? Who operates that? How many states subscribe to that? And who monitors that?
Donna, thank you.
Is it a private business?
We're short on time here. Laurel, what about Eric?
So Eric is, and you can look this up online. They have a lot of information about kind of their structure and who the current members are. I don't know off the top of my head how many states. I know it's a fairly sizable number of states that participate in Eric and pay fees to be part. So the state pays to be a member of Eric. It's kind of like a subscription service. I don't know, again, exactly those numbers off the top of my head. So that would be something that I think the Eric website would be able to tell you.
Donna, thank you. Laurel, in the last few moments here, how did the federal judges comment on our state's election processes in general?
So this was a really fascinating decision from the Seventh Circuit Court. I would encourage people to look at it if they're interested. I think two of the big takeaways, one were was that they talked a lot about Wisconsin election laws in comparison to other states. And they said that Wisconsin actually has a more accommodating system than a number of other states across the country. They pointed to in-person registration on election day. A number of states don't do that. And actually, they pointed to our early voting and said that the 13 days of early voting that they're allowing in their decision is actually more than a lot of states have. Some states don't offer early in-person voting. So that was a pretty interesting part of their decision, I think.
Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter. She co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with Senator John Erpenbach. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. We'll be back for more State Cap after this news update on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democratic lawmakers are promoting legislation to help protect and support healthcare workers who are on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic. The bill is called the Healthcare Heroes Act. In Wisconsin, healthcare workers make up 9% of COVID-19 cases, or nearly 2,900 cases to date. Do you work in a hospital or clinic? What has your work been like since March? What support do you need? How is your facility managing amid the pandemic? Join in 800-642-1234. Democratic State Senator John Erpenbach represents District 27, which is in the south-central part of the state, including Baraboo, Mazamani, Mount Horeb, and New Glarus. He serves on the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Senator Erpenbach, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. How are you?
I'm doing all right. So this Healthcare Heroes Act that was introduced, the bill would require hospitals to pay their workers more during a public health emergency. How have the state's hospitals responded to this proposal?
I think the hospitals are open to it. Obviously, it's an extremely difficult job right now, whether you are working in the ICU or you're working at admitting or whatever the case may be. The healthcare workers, not only in Wisconsin but across the country, just a tremendous amount of stress and a lot of long hours since March, since this has all happened. So, you know, this isn't the end-all be-all, but it certainly goes beyond just saying thank you to our healthcare workers, and it actually puts a little bit of money behind our thank yous.
What have you heard from healthcare workers at this time? How does this bill address their concerns?
Well, they certainly appreciate it. I mean, again, if you drive all over Wisconsin, you'll see signs up in cornfields, or you'll see signs in cities or suburbs basically saying thank you to all our healthcare providers with big hearts. And again, that's a great thing. I got to believe if I'm a healthcare provider and I'm driving to work or coming home from work, I see that, I appreciate it. But at the same time, we need to recognize the fact that the amount of stress that they're under should be rewarded with hazard pay, with paid time off, with all sorts of stuff like that that we possibly can do. So I think the healthcare workers and those who take care of us when we do get sick certainly appreciate what we're trying to do.
And so when that healthcare worker, when their test comes back positive, this bill would require 15 days of paid medical leave. What is the situation right now for Wisconsin healthcare workers?
Well, I mean, obviously, you're walking into a situation. I kind of compare it to firefighters. We all run away from fires, and firefighters run into the fire. And it's the same thing with the healthcare providers across the state of Wisconsin, and the fact that they go to work, and in the back of their mind, they have to be thinking, I'm dealing with very sick people. I'm dealing with people who have tested positive. I'm dealing with people who may or may not have tested positive, and they're walking through the doors of the clinics or the hospitals across the state. So they're putting, you know, their health at risk right there. You know, whether they're wearing masks and shields and gloves and everything else, they're taking a much greater risk than the rest of Wisconsin is and making sure they can do their job and take care of us. So, again, they're in a situation where they go to work and they're going basically to where the virus is, where most of us are trying to get away from where the virus is.
I'm wondering, does the bill reach into healthcare workers who work in nursing homes or long-term care facilities? What about orderlies or people who work in hospital cafeterias, for instance?
Right. It's defined as all healthcare providers. Cafeteria workers, I'm not certain. I think they may be covered. I tell you, a group of providers that weren't covered under this, but we're going to amend the bill to make sure they are covered, are EMTs. And so they're going to be covered under this through an amendment. But again, it basically, anybody who works in the healthcare industry who makes under $100,000 a year would be covered by this.
We're talking with State Senator John Erpenbach with us on the State Capitol Report, getting details of the recently introduced Healthcare Heroes Act. Healthcare workers, let's hear from you. What has your work been like since March? What supports do you need? How is your facility managing amid the pandemic? Join in at 800-642-1234. So this proposal would have state health department pay for COVID-19 testing and treatment of healthcare workers if they don't have insurance. Do we know how often that's the case? What percentage of the state's healthcare workers are uninsured?
I don't know that number off the top of my head, but the free testing is important because there are situations where somebody may not have insurance. We're also mandating that insurance, if you do have insurance, that they have to cover the testing and the treatments. And again, that's just as important. So making sure that regardless whether you are insured or not insured, that you're covered as far as testing and treatment is concerned.
Do you find that the state would have the ability to take on these extra costs in the event that they are, you know, treating these patients and covering their medical bills?
In this situation, we would. Excuse me. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of federal money that came our way. But at the same time, we're also in the legislation seeking the Medicaid expansion, which my Republican colleagues have said no to for the past, I don't know, 150 years. But the idea of expanding Medicaid in the state of Wisconsin not only gets people making low wages in the state of Wisconsin, gets them covered with insurance, but it also frees up more money for us to do things like this. So again, it's something where if you're going to basically be putting your health at risk by doing your job that you're expected to do, at the very least we can do here in Wisconsin is make sure that you have access to testing and treatment, or, you know, paid leave if you need it, and certainly hazard pay during a pandemic.
Your Republican colleagues have continually said no to the effort to expand Medicaid under the federal law.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, why do you think this time may be different, that they would support an expansion?
Well, if you take a look at the history of the Medicaid expansion since the Affordable Care Act came into play, it was designed with the idea that all states would take the expansion, and in the beginning, quite a few states didn't. And it was mostly political, to be honest with you, Kate. The Republican governors who would not take the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion because of a Democratic president and the idea that, you know, mandating health insurance is a bad thing. But over the course of time, more and more states accepted the expansion, both in Democratic states and Republican states. I'm talking about the administrations. Here in Wisconsin, if I talk to some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, they'll basically call it a welfare program. And it's not. I mean, you're not expanding welfare. You're giving access for low-income Wisconsinites to make sure that they have affordable health care coverage. Number one, it's the right thing to do. And number two, it saves all of us money if people are insured. The reason why it may be different this time is if you take a look at our overall state budget, and because of COVID-19, we're financially hurting. And it's going to be worse as the numbers continue to roll in. So we're going to be looking for places where we can raise the revenue we need without really, you know, gouging the taxpayers of the state. And the Medicaid expansion is the easiest way to do it. And to put a number on this, since we have refused to take the Medicaid expansion over the history of the Affordable Care Act, Wisconsin's lost over $1 billion of federal funding. Now, we say federal funding, but it's actually Wisconsin's tax dollars coming back to the state. You know, we don't say no when they expand the transportation funding. We don't say no when they expand K-12 education funding. But we have an opportunity, again, given our situation financially in the state, that it's going to be a really difficult upcoming budget, to take the expansion and do the right thing with the money, make sure that people have access to affordable health care, but also help pay for programs like this for health care providers who need hazard pay, who need paid time off, who need testing and treatment. So that's why I think it may be different this time.
Let's bring in a call now. David is with us from Viroqua. Hi, David.
Hi. I think that probably our healthcare workers, I know quite a few, appreciate the efforts that you're making with this bill. But it seems to me most of them would have preferred that the Republicans hadn't thrown Safer at Home in the trash without any options.
Well, that's, David, that's an extremely frustrating issue to talk about. The idea that the Republican leadership takes the Safer at Home Act to the Supreme Court, and we had a pretty good idea of the outcome as far as what the verdict was going to be from the Supreme Court. But the idea, then you hit it on the button there, the idea that, okay, we don't want this. Okay, if you don't want Safer at Home, what's your plan? And there's no alternative. So what we have right now, for example, Dane County had to scale back their opening. Sauk County and Columbia County haven't scaled back, and they're right next to each other. And it creates not only inequities but safety concerns within this region of Dane County, Sauk County, Columbia County. So, again, the idea is to say that, you know, we don't like Safer at Home. Okay, that's fine. Then what do you like? And the frustration of both the speaker and the majority leader not working with the governor to, come up with alternatives that are not only safe but fair from one end of the state to the other, we haven't dealt with that. So as a result, you know, depending on where you happen to live in Wisconsin, you know, maybe you can go into a restaurant and there's a lot of people there, or maybe you can go into a restaurant and they can only have 25% capacity. So, again, that's been a real frustrating issue.
So with the legislature having adjourned for the year, are you confident a special session will be convened to vote on this bill, to vote on other things to help in this pandemic?
Well, I know the Senate has, we should be back in session one more day just to finish up a bunch of unfinished business that we didn't deal with back in March when the state was shut down for a while. So we're supposed to be in, you know, sometime maybe this month or next month, but even if we're not, it takes 2 seconds, Kate, for the majority leader and the speaker to agree to have a special session and get us back in, whether it's online or in person or a combination of both. It does not take much at all to call the legislature back into session. And again, dealing with the pandemic issues that we are dealing with and expecting the health care providers to show up and do their job, which they've been doing hour after hour, day after day, and not reward them as best as we possibly can, you know, to me that's kind of sad. But it takes next to nothing for the leadership to call us back into a special session to deal with this stuff.
We have Democratic State Senator John Erpenbach on the line as we work through developments at the Capitol. What do you want state lawmakers to prioritize in this health crisis? Could lawmakers come together around police reform or racial inequities? Where do you see common ground? What legislation would help Wisconsinites build healthier communities? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back for more State Cap with Senator Erpenbach here on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Democratic State Senator John Erpenbach of West Point on the line. His district is in the south-central part of the state. Have you filed an unemployment claim with the state? Has it been processed? If you've been furloughed or laid off, what do you want state lawmakers to know about your situation? Would you support using state reserves at this time, and where would you direct the money? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. State Senator John Erpenbach stays with us. Let's take another call now. Sandy is with us from Mineral Point. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Senator Erpenbach. Thank you for taking my call, Kate. I am wondering if non-emergency medical drivers will be amended in as well as EMTs. Non-emergency medical drivers are people who take Medicare and Medicaid patients to and from their doctor's appointments, other medical appointments that are not of an emergency basis. And we're all pretty much contract drivers, most mostly contract drivers, and I'm wondering if we'll be covered too.
Not certain on that. I know Representative Vining, who was the assembly author, and I are hearing from people such as yourself and EMTs and others who are, I would tend to say that they're directly involved in providing health care, whether you're driving patients or not. But we're open to expanding the legislation to make sure that we cover everybody who should be covered under this. What we did originally was, you know, when you think about the healthcare providers, you think about nurses and so on, but there's more to it than that. There's a lot more people involved in making sure that when you do have access to good quality healthcare, there are people behind the scenes who we don't even begin to know about, who are all chipping in and doing their jobs and making sure they're taking the best care of all of us that they possibly can. So we're going to certainly continue to field those kinds of questions and be open to amending the legislation to include people that the categories of workers that we haven't even begun to think about or even knew about.
Sandy, thank you for calling in and for your work. I want to switch gears here, Senator, to look at systemic racism. And since the death of George Floyd, we've seen the protests across the nation. We've seen the protests across Wisconsin. What can the legislature do to address disparities?
Well, there's a lot we can do to address the disparities. I mean, there's laws on the books right now, Kate, that have been there, whether they were intentionally racist or not, over the course of the history of the state, that are still there. We can begin by putting together a list of legislation that just automatically creates inequities throughout our state. And we've had some recently, as a matter of fact. The voter ID legislation that passed a few years back to make it more difficult not only to register to vote, but make it more difficult to vote. To me, whether anybody agrees or disagrees with it is racist. I mean, it's there to make sure that it's more difficult for minorities to vote. That's not fair. That does not create equal opportunity here in the state of Wisconsin. There is legislation that had passed a little while back that deals with landlord-tenant issues, and it made life a lot better legally in the state of Wisconsin for landlords than it did tenants by taking away rights. That does not create equal opportunity in the state of Wisconsin. If you take a look at our K-12 education system and the way we fund our schools right now, that does not create equal opportunities throughout the state of Wisconsin. Access to internet, something that simple, Kate, access to internet does not create equal opportunities throughout the state of Wisconsin. So there certainly are things we can do. There are things we can do when it comes to, you know, having whether it be counties or cities take a look at how they police. And when you talk about police reforms, there are officers who are sent to situations that perhaps a social worker might be better suited to handle those situations. We expect our officers to be everything, and they can't be everything. And as a result, there's a lot of tension built around that as well. So there are all sorts of things we can do, but you have to start with a basic idea or the basic principle that if you're going to pass a law, does it create equal opportunity? If it doesn't, then we shouldn't do it. If there are laws on the books that create inequities from one end of the state to the other and they're there, then maybe they should be revised or taken off the books. So you just start with the basic premise that, and you recognize that everybody in this state has something to offer, and that everybody in this state should have access to equal opportunities, I think life in Wisconsin would be better. It sounds kind of Pollyannish, but at the same time, there's nothing preventing us from doing that. So when the legislation comes up, and there's legislation that deals with, you know, trying to make things better for, you know, people in Wisconsin, you better make sure that you create that opportunity to make things better for everybody in this state, not just depending on the zip code you happen to live in or the amount of money that you make in the state.
Talking with John Erpenbach, represents District 27 in the state Senate, South Central Wisconsin Communities. You can join in. You have a direct line to the state senator, 800-642-1234. Let's look at the unemployment claim issue, the extra $600 a week of unemployment benefits from the CARES Act. That ends later this month. What have you seen there as we see approximately a million claims not being processed yet? Should Wisconsin increase its own payments?
Well, what I've seen is just a tremendous amount of frustration. And if you go back a little bit, there was an audit done on unemployment a while back under the Walker administration, and there were problems back then. It doesn't excuse the problems that we have today, but nothing was done as far as upgrading software and making sure that, that when somebody does file a claim, that they have access to the money as soon as we possibly can get it to them. There's also legislation passed by the Republican majority to make it tougher to file and tougher to get your unemployment. That being said, we were in a situation back in March where the state pretty much shut down and no system was ready to handle the volume that they did, and they did the best job they could. All of that being said, Kate, it's still frustrating because I hear daily from people, whether it's on the phone or email or just walking around the district, that they filed a long time ago and they did everything they were supposed to do and they answered all the questions and they still don't have their money. There shouldn't be any excuse for a delay in the payments now. I mean, we're in July now. I know that they've added, you know, hundreds of people to answer phone calls and deal with the emails and try and streamline the process and make it better. But there's still that frustration out there. And I know workforce development and the people working over there are working very hard and trying the best they can, but they need more support.
How would you add more support, or what could you change to expedite the system?
What you could do is expand hours even more. I know they've already expanded hours once, but you could expand them even more. You could try and hire more people or shift more public employees over there and train them up quickly to make sure that they can address some of the concerns out there and answer questions for those who are unemployed right now and waiting on their money. And there are people who have filed, you know, months ago and still haven't received anything. Again, it's a situation where nobody could see this coming. And you don't plan for pandemics when it comes to unemployment. It's just, you know, when you did the audit a few years back, they didn't approach it from the fact that, okay, what happens if we have a pandemic and everything shuts down and you know, a couple of million people file for unemployment. But, again, that doesn't excuse where we are today in July, where this happened back in March. So,
well, let's try to squeeze in one more call here.
Okay.
Laverne in Monroe. Hi, Laverne.
Hello. John.
Laverne.
Yeah. Is Joe Biden going to have yard signs this year, and who would you contact?
Is Joe Biden going to have signs? Was that the question?
Right.
I would imagine he probably will, but I would contact the state party for that.
You wouldn't know who that name may be in the number.
Nah, that I don't know.
Well, Laverne, thank you so much for calling in. In these last few moments we have with you, what do you think about the DNC and how it will approach Milwaukee?
You know, this is, if you think about Wisconsin economically as a whole, not only will, you know, southeastern Wisconsin and certainly south central Wisconsin financially take a hit because of what happened with COVID and the DNC, but I think they're doing the right thing. I don't think they're being overly cautious. You know, we're still going to have the convention. It's still going to move forward, but it's just going to look a little different. But financially, if you take a look at it from that standpoint, you know, those who deal in the hospitality industry, that's a lot of money walking out the door, and that's too bad. But the convention is going to move forward, and it's going to be done safely. Pandemics don't stop our government. They don't stop our political process. They don't stop our elections. So we do need to keep moving forward on that.
Senator Erpenbach, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Kate.
State Senator John Erpenbach is a Democrat representing District 27. Just ahead, it's Mondays with Mike. We take your questions, hear your thoughts on WPR. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.